live from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome all of you. We have a packed show today. The latest on healing macular degeneration, helping our arteries, protecting against mercury and other heavy metal toxins getting into our body, how to chelate them out. I'm going to spend more time today on why we should be eating apples. Lots of good comes from eating an apple or drinking apple juice. And fiber, what it does, especially for young men. My guest in the second part of our program will be Chris Hedges, and we're going to take a look at America's class war. And I'm also going to be sharing a commentary from Dr. Margaret Flowers from Counterpunch on why Obamacare will fail to solve our healthcare crisis. I've written my own commentary on that as well. For those of you who have stopped paying attention to Fukushima or to eating fish or seaweed from Japan, you're going to have to focus on the 28 signs that the West Coast is being absolutely fried with nuclear radiation from Fukushima, from environmental lawyer Michael Snyder. We're also going to take a look at the latest on What America Has Become by John Chuckman from Countercurrents. We have a lot to share, including my own commentaries, and time permitting, I want to focus upon, finally, it is out in the open. Wikipedia admits hundreds of sock puppet editors gang up to make distorted edits to their pages. Now, we've known this for some time. For example, when I try to correct any misinformation about what Wikipedia stated about myself, immediately, within minutes, something else is added, and my information is never allowed to be put there. And it's always information that would have to have come from the quackbusters or the pharmaceutical puppets. Well, now we can go further. We can prove all this, and I'll discuss that if time permits. Let's begin. Rosemary is a common herb. It imparts a unique flavor, especially if, let's say, for you were roasting potatoes. You'd want rosemary. Rosemary and black pepper and Himalayan sea salt and extra virgin olive oil, that's a great combination. But it does more than that. Rosemary is good for macular degeneration. And I talked about resveratrol being good for macular degeneration and some other things. But now, here's what happens. According to a journal, Investigative Ophthalmology and Visual Science, a team from Sanford Burman Medical Research Institute found the following, that this simple herb can make a major difference in stopping the underlying cause of macular degeneration. Now, we know that macular degeneration, which is the number one cause of blindness, has many risk factors. For example, if you smoke, if you have a lot of sun exposure, if you have high blood pressure or diabetes, or if you're obese, even genetics plays a minor role. And in this study, they found that the retinal cells treated with carnosic acid found in rosemary triggered the production of protective antioxidant enzymes in the cells. That in turn lowered cell damage and free radicals. They also tested carnosic acid in animals, finding that mice treated with it suffered less vision damage when exposed to light. So rosemary has a lot of healing benefits, and it's been used for thousands of years. The ancient Greeks used it. They believed it helped with their brains and thinking and memory. And in fact, Greek students wore rosemary sprigs in their hair when studying for exams. We now know that it could have some of the benefits of protecting against dementia. And studies with rosemary showed that it acts as an antidepressant and improves type 1 diabetes. Now, I recently was counseling a man with type 1 diabetes who made major improvements in his blood sugar, dropped his need for insulin by almost 90%, and to test it, he took his blood fasting glucose, his blood sugar in the morning, and it was 185. Now, that's very high, requiring insulin. He then had a very large meal, and in the meal, afterwards, he had a large dessert. Now, normally, you could reasonably expect a spike up to 250, 300 on a blood sugar level. All bad. But based upon the protocol he was on and the nutrients he was taking and the herbs, his blood sugar was at 85, and it absolutely shocked him. And he said he couldn't believe it, so he repeated it the next day. And again, the same positive results. So we now know that we can help type 1 diabetics to lower their requirements of insulin if they're on the right program. It also helps prevent some of the weight gain from a high-fat diet. A Kansas State University study found that rosemary was the most effective of a whole group of spices tested to reduce the effects of the heterocyclic amines. Now, heterocyclic amines are bad. They're carcinogenic compounds that are found in beef and chicken and pork and fish when you heat them. You heat them at a temperature that actually kills the bacteria in them and neutralizes some of the parasitic action. Then you create these heterocyclic amines. And rosemary had a very positive effect on that. And by the way, the more meat you eat, the more grilled or barbecued meat that you eat, the more colorectal cancer, stomach cancer, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, mammary cancer, and prostate cancers. So look at rosemary, a Mediterranean herb that could be used in a lot of dishes. You can also use it in stews as well. Makes a difference. Something else that helps us is called curcumin. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. And it has now been shown in a major study to help protect us against mercury toxicity. Mercury is really insidious. You're getting it in almost all the fish that you're eating because mercury has been dumped into the water. It comes from coal-burning power plants, goes into the air, and it's a non-ferrous metal, and it's a major source of toxic reactions within the human body. It's even in the vaccines that we inject directly into our blood. It's in the mercury amalgam fillings. 52% of your silver filling isn't silver at all. It's mercury. And of course, we excrete it, and then it goes into the water systems. It's even used in the thermometers. And so you don't want mercury. You want to keep it out of your system, but we have it in our systems. Everyone has it to some degree. So what do we do about it? Well, we have to take a look at the latest studies. And the latest studies from the Indian Institute of Toxicology found that curcumin protects against mercury damage by detoxifying and acting as a prophylactic and therapeutic role. And that's important. So that's great for us. So my suggestion, between 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day of curcumin. We've all heard the cliche, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And they're correct on many levels. Of course, it's only one small piece. If you ate an apple a day and then you drank, smoked, ate a lot of bad foods, was highly stressed, the apple's not going to do you much good. But if you're really making an effort to try to do as much as possible to get yourself healthy, it's a good start. Why? Because of all the top fruits found in nature, the apple is in the top 10. And that's because its blend of phytonutrients and antioxidants that can help reduce our risk of cancer, hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease. A mainstream medical news today featured the article as a breakthrough fruit. Why? Well, because it's vitamin C. It didn't have a lot of vitamin C, but it has the phytonutrients. But there was good research on how that can help fight against infectious agents. University of Maryland Medical Center did that. And then it has the B complex. It has fiber. The British National Health Service says that a diet high in fiber can help prevent the development of certain diseases and lower your bad cholesterol. And it's true. But I believe that the real reason that the apple is so important is because of the flavonoids, the polyphenolics, which are all part of the phytonutrients. Now, these phytonutrients help protect your body from free radicals. And that's really the good part. And the most powerful part of the apple is the skin. And that's where you get your best benefit. So what do we know today from good science, not just speculation, that the apple can do? It has neurological health because it is rich in quercetin. Quercetin. C-E-T-I-N. It helps reduce cellular death caused by oxidation and inflammation of neurons. And that is according to a scientist at the University of Quebec. It prevents dementia. Researchers at Cornell University, published in the Journal of Food Science, found that evidence that apples can help, quote, protect neuron cells against oxidative stress, induce neurotoxicity. That, in turn, could reduce the risk of developing neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's. It reduces your risk of stroke. A study of 9,208 men and women showed that those who ate the most apples over a 20-year period had the lowest incidence of stroke. And they concluded, quote, the results suggest that the intake of apples is related to a decreased risk of thrombotic stroke. It lowers your bad cholesterol. The Florida State University found that apples really had a, quote, miracle fruit effect. They found that older women who ate apples every day had 23% less of the LDL bad cholesterol and 4% more of the good HDL cholesterol after just 6 months. It reduced the risk of diabetes. That's correct. Apples could also reduce or lower your risk of diabetes. In a large study of 180,000 people, they found that those who ate 3 servings of apples per week, as well as some blueberries and grapes, had a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared to those who didn't. And very important, some good research at Cornell University found that it lowers the risk of breast cancer. In fact, the idea, and it's growing in evidence, that an apple a day can help prevent breast cancer is solidly supporting. A researcher, Professor Liu, said that her research adds, quote, to the growing evidence that increased consumption of fruits and vegetables, including apples, would provide consumers with more phenolics, phen, P-H-E-N, olics, O-L-I-C-S, which are proving to have important health benefits. I would encourage consumers to eat more and a wide variety of fruit and vegetables daily, end quote. And also, there's no harmful side effects. So, but try to get organic apples because there's heavy spraying of non-organics. So that's our fruit of the day. And also flax, which I just mentioned yesterday on this program, being so good for us. New research shows that it cuts the hunger feeling in young men. This was the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, which, by the way, Denmark yesterday was just shown to be the happiest nation in the world per population, and for a lot of reasons, some that we would never imagine associated with happiness. For example, half of all people every day in the country bike to work or bike to places and back each day, making far more fit, less obese, living longer by an average of 3 years, and lowering their carbon footprint. They also give longer maternity leave. They are more conscientious as a society about each other's well-being. And they spend more time upon quality of life than we do in the United States. We spend more time working and engaged in stressful activity. They don't. Now, this is the study from the University of Copenhagen on 2.5 grams, which is a small amount. That would be like, 28 grams to an ounce. We're looking at an eighth of a teaspoon. So we're just talking about a little bit of flax fiber. These results point toward a potential of purified flaxseed dietary fiber to moderate severe and several risk factors through effects on lipid metabolism as well as appetite regulation, end quote. And that was published in the peer-reviewed journal, Nutrition, Metabolism, and Cardiovascular Disease. So the takeaway message, if you want to control your appetite, have a glass of water with a little bit of flaxseed fiber in it. And finally, red meat is linked to an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. This was reported in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. The study was done at Harvard School of Public Health. And what they found was that when you consume red meat, you're increasing your risk of type 2 diabetes, particularly processed meat, you know, the kind you get on, well, pizzas, for example. The study also shows that replacing red meat with healthier proteins such as nuts and whole grains can significantly lower the risk of type 2 diabetes. But you already knew that. And they had followed 79,000 women for 28 years and 37,000 men, physicians, for 20 years in the health professionals follow-up study. So it's a big study. Quote, clearly the results from this study have huge public health implications given the rising type 2 diabetes epidemic and increasing consumption of red meats worldwide. The good news is that such troubling risk factors can be offset by swapping red meat for healthier protein. And by the way, it was 23% lower risk of diabetes. Well, now when you consider how bad diabetes is and that it's a pandemic, all the more reason to pay attention to that information. I'm Gary Nall. We're always interested in improving the quality of our lives. And I want to thank all of the people who've been listening to our station and then all of its sister stations around the United States and all the people all over the world for passing on information. Every day, you could go to the Huffington Post and find some articles. You could go over to MSNBC and the Wall Street Journal and almost all their articles are covering the same identical topics and the same celebrity news. We don't have celebrity news. We don't have sports news. We don't deal with these topics. We present every day dozens of articles on themes that are absolutely essential to allowing us to live a better quality of life. And these are from some of the finest independent-minded thinkers in the world. Go to my website, for example, and just look at the articles posted today. I think there's about 60. And look at the themes of them. And look at the content. And ask yourself, where in the world could you read these? Occasionally you can read a really interesting and provocative and accurate article in The Nation magazine. But this is the same magazine that refused to acknowledge the power of change through supporting multiple candidates. Instead, they align with Obama, as they did with Clinton, etc. So no, we're not aligning with any political and ideological basis. Also, you can listen to this program anywhere in North America by calling up a telephone number. And we're number one now in the world listening over the telephone. I mean, there are so many thousands of radio stations outlet using phone service, but we're number one. 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. That way you're never out of touch. From our environmental segment, this is from Michael Snyder. And Michael is an attorney, graduated from University of Virginia, and also has a law degree from University of Florida Law School, and he researches and writes on ways of trying to awake Americans. And his blog is the Economic Collapse blog. Here's what he says. He gives a map, and we've posted this article. And the map comes from the Nuclear Emergency Tracking Center. It shows that radiation levels at radiation monitoring stations all over the country are elevated. Now, as you can see on this map, this is particularly true along the west coast of the United States. Every single 24 hours, 300 tons of radioactive water from Fukushima enters the Pacific Ocean. That means that the total amount of radioactive material released from Fukushima is constantly increasing and is steadily building up in our food chain. Ultimately, all this nuclear radiation will outlive all of us by 1,000 years. And yet, we're not paying any attention to it. So here's why he believes we should pay attention, especially to all of our listeners on the West Coast. Polar bears, seals, and walruses along the Alaskan coastline are suffering from fur loss and open sores. Wildlife experts are studying whether fur loss and open sores detected in 9 polar bears in recent weeks is widespread and related to similar instances among seals and walruses. The bears were among 33 spotted near Barrow, Alaska, during routine surveys. And this was reported by the U.S. Geological Survey. There's an epidemic of sea lion death along the California coastline. In fact, it is the worst they've ever recorded. An island rockeries off the Southern California coast found 45% of the pups born in June have died. And according to Sharon Mellon, a wildlife biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service, they said normally less than 1/3 of pups would die. It's gotten so bad in the past 2 weeks that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared, quote, unusual death event. Along the Pacific coast of Canada and the Alaska coastline, the population of sockeye salmon is at the lowest level ever. Something is causing fish all along the west coast of Canada to bleed from their gills, bellies, and eyeballs. A vast field of radioactive debris from Fukushima that is approximately the size of California has crossed the Pacific Ocean and is starting to collide with the West Coast. It's there. It's been there. It is being projected that radioactivity of coastal waters off the United States West Coast could double over the next 5 years. Experts have found very high levels of cesium-137 and plankton living in the waters of the Pacific Ocean between Hawaii and the West Coast. One test in California found that 15 out of 15, or 100% bluefin tuna, were contaminated with extremely high levels of radiation from Fukushima. But they were found off the coast of California, not off the coast of Japan. Also, the Vancouver Sun reported that cesium-137 was found, quote, in very high percentages of fish that Japan was selling to Canada. 73% of mackerel, 91% of halibut, 92% of sardines, 93% of tuna and eel, 94% of cod and anchovies, 100% of all the carp, seaweed, shark, and monkfish were contaminated with cesium-137. And that was a year ago. Canadian authorities are finding extremely high levels of nuclear radiation in certain fish samples. Some fish samples tested to date have such high levels, like sea bass. They had 1,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium. That's way off the chart. Some experts believe that we would see very high levels of cancer along the West Coast just from people eating contaminated fish. Quote, look at what's going on now. They're dumping huge amounts of radioactivity into the ocean. No one expected that in 2011. By the way, this is from Daniel Hirsch, a nuclear policy lecturer at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Quote, we could have large numbers of cancer from ingesting a fish. BBC News recently reported that radiation levels from Fukushima was 1,800% higher than previously believed. A European Union-funded study concluded that Fukushima has released 210 quadrillion becquerels of cesium-137 in the atmosphere. Atmospheric radiation from Fukushima reached the west coast of the United States within a few days back in 2011. It's been here. Today, every 24 hours, 300 tons of contaminated water is pouring in the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima. A senior researcher of marine biology at the Japan Meteorological Agency's Institute says that 30 billion measurements of radioactive cesium and 30 billion measurements of radioactive strontium are being released into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima every 24 hours. According to TEPCO, about 30 trillion measurements of radiation, such as tritium, have gotten into the Pacific Ocean. And according to a professor at Tokyo University, 3 gigabecquerels of cesium-137 are flowing into the port every day. And it's been estimated that up to 100 times as much nuclear radiation has been released into the ocean from Fukushima than was released during the entire Chernobyl disaster. And also it's being projected that significant levels of cesium-137 will reach every corner of the Pacific Ocean in the next 5 years. It's also being reported that the entire Pacific Ocean will soon see 100% higher levels of radiation than at any time, including during the heavy atomic bomb testing in the Pacific decades ago. And the immense amount of nuclear radiation getting into the water in the Pacific Ocean has caused environmental activists such as Joe Martino to issue the following warning, quote, "Your days of eating Pacific Ocean fish are over." The iodine-131, the cesium-137, the strontium-90 that are constantly coming from Japan's Fukushima are going to affect the health of those living in the northern hemisphere for a very, very long time. That's from Harvey Wasserman, Professor Wasserman. Quote, iodine-131 can be ingested into the thyroid where it emits beta particles, electrons, the damaged tissue. A plague of damaged thyroid has already been reported among as many as 40% of the children in Fukushima area. That percentage can go higher. In the developing youngsters, it can stunt both physical and mental growth. And its half-life is 29 years. It also mimics calcium and goes into your bones. A study conducted last year came to the conclusion that radiation from Fukushima nuclear disaster could negatively affect human life along the West Coast for decades. That includes Alaska, Mexico, and all the West Coast. Yale professor Charles Perrow is warning that if the cleanup of Fukushima is not handled with 100% precision, that humanity could be threatened for thousands of years. Because conditions in the Unit 4 pool, 100 feet from the ground, are perilous, and if any two of those rods touch, it could cause a nuclear reaction that would be uncontrollable. The radiation emitted from all those rods, if they are not continually cool and kept separate, would create the evacuation of surrounding areas, including Tokyo. Because of the radiation at the site, there are 6,375 rods in the common storage pools that could not be continuously cooled. They would fission, and all of humanity on the earth would be threatened for thousands of years, end quote. So, unlike other media that don't give you any information on Fukushima or what's being done, we will, and we'll keep you up to date on all the things that are important to know. I'm Gary Knoll. A couple of things. First, we're going to just take a moment here because in the last 2 weeks we haven't raised any money for our own Progressive Radio Network, and none of the other programs have ever in the 10 years had to raise a penny because we've been successful with our process of offering a special at a great price of a very important health product, and you, the audience, have been supportive. And today we have back in stock. We were out of it because I was reformulating it. In fact, I reformulated almost everything in the last 5 months. That's why some items have been out of stock for a period of time. But now they're almost all back in. Well, today this is back. Supremacy, strawberry flavor, 24 ounce, the big size. This should last you about 6 months. And it's buffered. It has highly absorbable ascorbated minerals. It has a wonderful strawberry flavor. It has bioflavonoids for enhanced utilization, and we know that this is quite simply one of the best antioxidants in the world. And we have it on sale. It also has, what is the sale price? Oh, here it is. Wow, $35.99. That is your sale price. That is a phenomenal price. For a big supply, mine lasts me, I take mine on the road with me, mine lasts me 6 months. So today's special, what many consider the finest vitamin C anywhere, strawberry flavor, Supremacy, 24 ounces, that's the giant 680 gram size of the buffered and terrific tasting vitamin C powder, one of the best absorbed that you could find anywhere. So give a call to participate. We only have 500 bottles in, at least at this time. Within a month, we'll get 5,000 bottles. But these just came in today. And I know many of you have been waiting for about 3 months because we've been out of it. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. You can pick it up at our vitamin closet at 83rd and Broadway, or at the health food store at 89th and Broadway. And Supremacy, back in stock, after a long out of stock, better than ever. Supremacy, strawberry flavor, 24 ounces, on sale for only $35.99. Call 877-627-5065. Back in a moment with commentary, and then after that, our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you for taking time out of your schedule to listen in. I know that many of you are concerned about what you see America evolving into. We're going to be going to our guest in about 7 minutes, Chris Hedges, to talk about this, especially the class warfare in America. But when we take a look at the popular myth of America's founding fathers as an earnest, civic-minded group gathered in a ornate hall, writing with quill pens, reading from leather-bound tomes, and offering heroic speeches and classical poses, all resembling Greek philosophers in wigs and spectacles and frock coats. Well, let us be honest. It was always a myth. And according to John Chuckman, they were in more than a few cases, very narrow, acquisitive men, ambitious for their own personal interest. And even the more philosophical types among them were well-read but largely unoriginal men who cribbed ideas and concepts and even whole phrases from European Enlightenment writers and British parliamentary traditions. Now, I realize that some people say, well, that's not possible, but it is possible. If you go back and read the work of John Locke and Jacques Rousseau, these were two of the primary influences dealing with the natural rights of humans. The idea that all men are created equal and the right to life, liberty, and the ownership of property came from both of them, especially Rousseau. A fundamental difference was the Jefferson believed in smaller government, and Rousseau believed in stronger government. Also, he was influenced by Voltaire, and Voltaire advocated freedom from religion, which is something that Jefferson would have embraced as a Masonic deist. Whether Jefferson had connections with the French Illuminati at the time, which had already infiltrated in French masonry, is to be another topic. The real historical Illuminati, not the conspiratorial ones, were in evidence, and there's good evidence that the Illuminati philosophers played a large part in the French Revolution and in their ideal of what is known as the noble savage, as the expression of man's natural state and being. And a lot of what we see in the Declaration of Independence really originated from the concept of natural rights. And that's what Jefferson put in the Declaration of Independence, about God's creation of man. And in 1690, and this was a long time before the United States Declaration of Independence was even conceived, before the institution of individual liberty was embraced by political leaders, John Locke, a philosopher during the English Revolution, wrote a ex post facto revelation for the English Revolution of 1688. Locke's work was called The Treatise of Civil Government, and it was very similar to Jefferson's Declaration. If you put the two together today, I'm quite sure one of the copyright services that check to see whether or not your material is plagiarized would have said Jefferson plagiarized. But if you looked more, let's say, more pragmatically, you'd say, okay, Jefferson used Locke's theory of natural rights as applied by government. Locke claimed that our rights are eternal, unchanging personal possessions which are superior to any government and beyond the legislative reach of ordinary politics. In fact, look at Jefferson's Inborn Rights of Man and a summary view of the rights of a British American, written in 1774 when he was in the Virginia House of Burgess. And then you start to see, gee whiz, Jefferson was really an advocate of the French Enlightenment, and this predisposed his understanding of human, of the human understanding. But it was really John Locke, who lived in the mid-1600s and died at the beginning of the 1700s. So what does this mean to us today? It means that we have taken much of our understanding of the principles of American Revolution and our Declaration of Independence and our constitutional liberties, and we're not even aware of where all these myths from these original individuals arose. False as they are, the very fact that there are such pleasant myths does not diminish our acceptance of them. Now, how would any future Americans manage to weave attractive myths about a president who sits in the Oval Office signing authorizations for teams of young buzzcut psychopaths in secret locked rooms to guide killing machines against mere suspects and innocent bystanders, none of whom have been found guilty in any court of law, none of whom have been provided a right of jurisprudence, none of whom have been had an opportunity to face their accusers? According to John Chuckman, after adapting the tactics of America's lunatic anti-abortion assassins, sending a second hellish missile into the crowd of neighbors who come to the assistance of victims of the first, is simply business as usual. How would they weave attractive myths about the CIA's international torture gulag, including the hellhole Guantanamo, where kidnapping and illegally detaining innocent people are imprisoned and tortured and given absolutely no rights or ethical treatment under international laws and conventions? Well, during the Revolutionary War, the battles were between armies, and captured soldiers were frequently granted their freedom if they pledged not to return to the fight. Spies, that was a different matter. No one liked the spies, so they were generally hung. Torture was actually uncommon and certainly not embraced as policy. So what myths can be written of two wars involving the deaths of a million or so people, the creation of millions of refugees, the needless destruction of huge amounts of other people's property, and all to achieve nothing but a change of government? Or about massive armed forces and secret security agencies which squander hundreds of billions of dollars in resources year after year, spreading their dark influence to all corners of the globe and offering an insurmountable obstacle to America's own citizens who might imagine they ever can rise against a government grown tyrannous. After all, polls in America show that its Congress is held in contempt by the overwhelming majority of its people, with percentages of disapproval rivaling those held of communism or satanic rituals. There are no myths about today's congressional figures. Everyone understands they are often to be found bellowing in ornate halls about points most Americans couldn't care less about. Everyone understands that they are ready to go anywhere and say almost anything for large enough campaign contributions, that they take off on junkets paid for by a group, hoping to influence votes and put faces to the exercise of future influence, trips commonly involving a foreign power trying to shape American policy, yes. That their work is often steeped in secrecy from the voters, secrecy not governed by genuine national security concerns, but by the often shameful nature of their work, yes. That a good deal of the legislation and rules that create repress in the people's interest and favor only special interests, yes. And in conclusion, that their government regularly suppresses inconvenient truths and labels those who raise questions as foolishly addicted to conspiracy or even as treacherous. Yes. What are just a few of the events which would have treated this whole concept in this way? The assassination of the president, the accidental or deliberate downing of at least 3 civilian aircraft by America's military in recent years, an Iranian airliner, TW Flight 800, on the East Coast, and the fourth plane on 9/11. Is that possible? How would we know if it's possible? We're never allowed to know the truth, nor to investigate it. The CIA's past cooperation and engagement with the American Mafia during the anti-Castro terror campaign, that's real. The CIA's use of drug trafficking to raise off-the-books income in Vietnam and in Nicaragua, that's real. The military's assassination of American prisoners of war cooperating with their Vietnamese captors, that was real. Obfuscating Israel's deliberate attack on an American intelligence gathering ship during its engineering 1967 war, that was real. The huge death toll of local civilian and military in America's grisly imperial wars from Vietnam to Iraq, all of those are real. The documented involvement of Mossad in following and recording the plotters inside the United States leaves disturbing unanswered questions. One also knows that America's established discovery in the wake of 9/11, the perfect opportunity for doing a great many nasty things it has always wanted to do anyway. You might say the terrorists did the military-industrial intelligence complex a big favor. Anti-democratic measures involving surveillance, privacy, and communications, secret prisons, torture, effective suspension of some of the Constitution are all parts of the new American reality. Oh, and by the way, the FBI can record what you borrow from the public library. The National Security Agency captures every single phone call, text, and email in the world. The TSA can strip search you for taking an inner-city bus. Drones are being used for surveillance, and TSA actually has a program of agents traveling along highways to stop those regarded as suspicious. And portable vans are now going throughout all the suburbs, seeing right through your house to whatever you're doing, and can record you in any way they choose. Yeah, it's not just airports anymore. Agencies of the government, much of the style of the Soviet Stasi, encourage reports from citizens about suspicious behavior. Yeah, well, that is dangerous. But so is all this. My guest is standing by. Let's go over and say hello to Chris Hedges. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris, by the way, those of you who are not familiar with, I know my audience is, Chris is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics, social and political activists, and authors. And for 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America, Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, and reported for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor. And while at the Times, he received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. In the same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. And he's written many good books. His latest is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which is a compelling hard look at the most impoverished regions of the United States that have become what Chris calls sacrifice zones for the benefit. And he has a co-author on that. Chris, We are getting information on the scope of the government's massive surveillance programs, and more every week. Well, you recently wrote an essay dealing with America's class war and the power and influence of the ruling oligarchy. How do you see the increasing surveillance of Americans serving to further empower and protect that group?
Well, it's more the surveillance. I think a lot of us, especially with the passage of the FISA Amendment Act, assumed that widespread surveillance of, at this point, virtually the entire citizenry, and we now know foreign nationals in France and Germany and everywhere else, was in existence. That's why I was one of the plaintiffs in the case that Amnesty International brought against Clapper, against the NSA. And it's interesting that when it was heard at the Supreme Court, the government argued that we as plaintiffs did not have standing because if we were in fact being monitored, the government had a legal obligation to inform us. We now know because of the revelations by Snowden that the government lied in the Supreme Court, and Amnesty is now thinking of going back and asking that the case is reheard. So this is something that's been going on for some time, but because of the courage of Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, it's been confirmed. And I think all of the measures, including the stripping away of our most basic and cherished civil liberties, and that would include habeas corpus. And as you know, I sued the president in the Southern District Court of New York over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which permits the U.S. military to carry out, in essence, extraordinary renditions of American citizens on American soil, overturning 150 years of domestic law that prohibited our military from carrying out acts of domestic policing, and the holding of people seized under this provision indefinitely in military facilities, stripped of due process. So the use of the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers 7 times by Barack Obama, including against Snowden, the radical interpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act, which the executive branch believes gives them the right to assassinate American citizens. This, along with a massive security and surveillance apparatus, is part of a process. And the process is to make sure that the corporate state has the tools and mechanisms at its disposal to prevent any kind of popular unrest, which they know is coming, both because of the deteriorating financial, both nationally and globally, financial situation and the effects of climate change. So I think what is frightening, perhaps, for the state is that wider and wider segments of the population are becoming cognizant of the fact that our democracy at this point is a fiction, that we have no protection left, that we have undergone a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, and it's over, and that the very ideas used to justify globalism and corporate capitalism are being discredited. And as they are discredited, the state has to resort more and more to force and violence in order to protect an increasingly discredited ruling elite. And I think that's both the right and the left are on that point are on the same page, that this, and you had, I heard in the introduction, you were talking about Congress. I think Congress has, what, a 9% approval rating?
Yes.
You know, this really crosses political spectrums. And so as the legitimacy of the system is challenged by increasing numbers of the civilians and the ideas which are used to justify the pillage on the part of our corporate overlords are discredited, then the state has nothing left to defend its interests, or the ruling elite has nothing left to defend its interests but security, surveillance, and violence. And that's really what's happening.
I appreciate that overview. For those in our audience who observe the goings-on in foreign countries like Greece, Spain, Ireland, that have been hit with austerity measures, where people have really had major sacrifices. That has been downplayed in the United States media. Even much of the alternative media has not been talking about it. But why, in your opinion, does the average American not observe and understand the economic and social and political impact that the austerity measures inflicted on Europe? And we could have found out if we wanted to, and already we're seeing aggressive efforts made by Washington to cut back on social programs across the board, and yet there is no effort to reduce the budgets of our military and intelligence expenditures and programs. There is no effort to reduce the financial giveaways to big agri, to big banks, to big pharma, and big agriculture and energy cartels. In effect, Americans are fundamentally illiterate in realizing how austerity policies will affect their lives. And then we have all the talk about the national budget and deficits, so there's nothing being heard about the massive subsidies corporate America receives, and yet how much all of this is going to impact them in the near future. Do you believe that's partly why there is such an effort to curtail dissent?
At this point, I'm not... The corruption within the systems of information, and I speak not only of the media but educational institutions, is so pervasive that it's extremely difficult for people to understand what's happening in the country we live in. Any kind of rational dissent, or rational debate is essentially shut out, and very effectively shut out. So it's become very hard even to have a thoughtful debate about the Affordable Health Care Act, which is a pretty bad bill. It's a corporate bill. But it's just this shrill carnival barking across the airwaves, along with celebrity gossip and the tawdry and the sexual and the violent. So one has to shut out the noise and become very proactive in order to get information. And this is especially true in the electronic media, but of course we've seen a deterioration in the print media, a pretty marked deterioration in the print media. So our systems of information, and as in all totalitarian states, no longer function, no longer serve the interests of the public. They have become systems largely of propaganda, spinning back one cliche after another. And those people who can provide thoughtful critiques are really ruthlessly shut out mass communication. So that, of course, as in any totalitarian state, makes it much harder for people to grasp how systems of power work and what it is that's actually happening to them. And I think that's where we are. But I do think that you're correct, Gary, that many people probably would have a hard time articulating what it is that's happening. I think they sense that what is happening is very, very bad and not in their interests. And I think that is reflected by the poll numbers and the angst on both the left and the right. And I'm obviously no fan of the Tea Party. But that again is a kind of evidence of ferment, of popular discontent. What frightens me is that the radical popular movements that created the New Deal and all of the openings of our democracy have been so thoroughly eviscerated and destroyed in the name of anti-communism that revulsion may have more of a propensity to express itself in a kind of proto-fascist Christian fascism. We who care about a more egalitarian and open society and one that is not built on violence, because of course these movements speak in the language of violence and celebrate the gun culture, have our hands tied behind our back, because all of our movements from labor unions to radical parties to alternative press have been wiped out.
Hmm. Recently, I watched Senator Ron Wyden talk about what he felt was important concerning the national security agencies, and he was on a committee overseeing them. And yet each time he was asked a question, there was a voice off camera saying, you can't answer that. And so all the important questions, he could say no comment. All he could say was the American public would be surprised if they knew all that was going on. Well, here's my issue. We have both a House and a Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees. You're talking about at least 25 people minimum who've had knowledge of what was going on, and not one of them has ever come forward and had the courage to say that this is wrong. We have to have a Snowden, we have to have a Manning or someone else tells us the truth. So then when Dianne Feinstein says, oh, don't worry about it and being surveyed upon because we have all kinds of checks and balances and congressional oversight, it's simply not true. Not a single member of any of these intelligence committees, including Jay Rockefeller and all the rest, not one of them has broken ranks. Not one of them has defied their so-called gag orders or what they can't say. If you know that there's a crime being committed against humanity, then you have some more obligation to inform the public and then let the public be on your side if they try to go against you on that. And yet no one has had the courage in Congress to do any of this. So we have been left in the cold on this. Your thoughts?
Well, that's evidence of the breakdown of the system. I mean, you know, we also know that the FISA court, which was supposed to oversee this, has also not worked. And in a rare kind of public dissent, the FISA court has even admitted that they don't know what's going on. So, I mean, this is what's so terrifying, is that the separation of powers is broken down. It no longer works. The entire system is essentially subservient to corporate power, whether it's the judiciary, the legislative, or the executive branch, and let's not forget a corporatized media. So we no longer have the mechanisms within these traditional structures of power by which we can protect ourselves from corporate malfeasance, fraud, criminality, and abuse. And that's the problem. The point that you raise, I mean, this point about oversight, this can be, writ large across every issue, whether it's the fossil fuel industry, whether it's our food system, which I know you talk a lot about, whether it's the health system, which you talk a lot about, in every single major area that affects our lives. We have no way to thwart corporate power and corporate looting, corporate poisoning, and corporate abuse at our expense. And that is the issue.
Chris, my final question is a larger arching issue. During the presidential debates and the election, The Nation magazine and its editorial staff chose to endorse Obama. I had written a detailed letter to the publisher and the editor saying, why aren't you paying attention to Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson, other third-party candidates? And because these offer real populist views. What you're doing is just more of the same. That was also true when they supported John Kerry and even Al Gore. Now you look at MSNBC, you even look at some programs on Pacifica that are popular, and some of the so-called liberal magazines and outlets, behind them, there's some form of self-censorship, and because they're not going after these issues. They're not foolish. They're very bright people. They could easily take these on, but they're choosing not to. They're selecting softer or less confrontational targets. Have you experienced this?
Well, like yourself, I was a supporter of Nader, including in 2008 when I wrote several of his major policy speeches for him, and then I voted for Stein in the last election. So I've been outside the two-party system for a long time. I think that there is a feeling, and I think it's well-intentioned but naive, among many people on the left that they can appeal to the better nature of the Democratic Party, and in particular Barack Obama. I think Barack Obama has now given ample evidence where his loyalty lies, and it doesn't lie with us. His assault on civil liberties has outstripped anything done by George W. Bush. His kill lists, his drone attacks, his inability to curb Wall Street, his failure to address the mortgage and foreclosure crisis, his failure to create a job programs that might ameliorate the chronic unemployment and underemployment. Half of our country now lives in poverty. You know, in the end, it doesn't matter what these politicians say. It matters what they does, what they do. And I think we now know who Barack Obama is, and we certainly know what he does. And, you know, that kind of faith and hope dies hard. I would not ascribe it to malfeasance or, you know, to anything malicious on the part of the left. I would, I just would write it off as a kind of naive liberalism.
I appreciate your insights. The new book is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And you can read Chris Hedges' essays on Monday on truthdig.com. Chris, as always, thank you very much for sharing your insights.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. We're at the end of our program. Thank you all very much for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now let's say hello to Utrece Leeds, standing by. Hi, Utrece.
Oh, hello, Gary. It seems as if we're kind of psychically in tune because we are continuing our discussion rating President Obama and his two administrations.
Ah, okay. That we will look forward to.
Thanks.
And Utrece, I thought you would like to know that the afternoon program that you held forth for, what was it, 22 years or 20 years on BAI?
Oh, a little less than that.
All right.
But for quite a while.
You now have an audience that is 500% larger than that audience on BAI. Just thought I'd share that with you.
I'll take it. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Gary.
Utrece Leeds right now.